Good morning and good afternoon, everybody, and also from the Swiss Re side, welcome to our 2013 annual results conference call. I'm here with George Quinn, our Chief Financial Officer, and Matthias Weber, our Group Chief Underwriting Officer. Today, we reported an excellent group net income of $4.4 billion, towards which all business units have contributed. The result was driven by sustained high profitability in property and casualty reinsurance and very good performance by Corporate Solutions and Admin Re. Life and Health Reinsurance delivered a reduced profit that was impacted by reserve strengthening in Australia. In our video presentation, I talked about the January renewal outcome and the combined ratio guidance for our P&C businesses. I also gave you a strategic update on Admin Re and Principal Investments, and I summarized the group's priority for 2014, which are an evolution of my scorecard for 2030. I'm very confident that our flexible business model will allow us to achieve both our strategic and our financial targets, so growing both our dividend and our business profitability. Our focus is firmly on these important goals. With that, I'll hand you to our Head of Investor Relations, Eric Xu, who will host the Q&A session.
Thank you very much, Michel. Now I'd like to turn to the Q&A, and as usual, could people please restrict themselves to two questions each and re-register for follow-up questions. So operator, could we please take the first question?
The first question comes from Jason Kalamboussis from Société Générale. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi, gentlemen. Good afternoon. The first question is on the combined ratio guidance. In 2013, you talk about the difference between the 92%, that was the original guidance, and 93%. And you said that, you know, the difference was, you have to take into account some restructuring and some higher attritional losses. So, a couple of questions on this. First, on the restructuring charges, I was not aware of those. Can you please elaborate, or are you likely to have any of those in 2014? Then if we look at the attritional losses, can you quantify if in there, there is an impact of softer prices, that we saw in 2013, notably through the summer? Because also then you focus in that comment and saying more that it's due to man-made losses. And, also, when I look at it, when we look at the 2014 guidance of 95%, you base it on 93%, which I don't understand in the way that, you know, if there were things like one-off, be it on restructuring or attritional, I would have thought that you would base it on the 92% basis. So that's the first question. And the second one is, on the Christmas shopping spree you did in Asia and Brazil. I think the market struggled to understand the third one, so the stake in China Life. I must admit, what I struggle a bit to understand is the two other ones for the following reason: I would have thought that the 10% to 15% stake positioning is ideal to develop a business relationship with those companies. But as hard as I try to get such an answer from you, you seem to be guiding to pure investment angle, since you argue that for growth, both sides have deep pockets, so they don't necessarily need a reinsurer if you want to accompany them in a strong growth direction that could be coming. Which brings me to the following: why don't you find investments where there is a strong short to medium-term rationale of business development with a target company? So apologies if they were a bit long questions, but hopefully you...
Yeah, I think it was clear enough, Jason. So I'm gonna I'll start with the restructuring piece. I'll give it to Matt then, and he can give you chapter and verse on the combined ratio, and then Michel will cover our so-called Christmas shopping spree. On the restructuring charges, we've made some significant changes in Germany to our Munich office. It's about a quarter of one combined ratio point. I mean, restructuring is one of these things that can come along from time to time. It hasn't typically disturbed the combined ratio in the past. Not the kind of thing that happens very frequently, but it can happen. But of course, it's not the thing you expect to recur. But, I mean, Matt, you've got a more comprehensive view of the combined ratio.
Okay, this is Matt Weber speaking. We came early last year out with a guidance of 92% for the business unit reinsurance. What actually then happened was we incurred a combined ratio of 93.6% after correcting for Nat Cat, the good luck on the Nat Cat side, and for prior year development. What is the difference between the 92 and the 93.6? It's actually a large number of relatively small items. The restructuring charge is one of them. We incurred a little bit more than average large man-made losses in the current accident year, which means in the accident year 2013. And on top of this, the loss ratio, and together with the loss ratio, of course, also the combined ratio, was a little bit higher than anticipated at the beginning of the year, because we incurred a little bit more rate decreases at the 6-1 and the 7-1 renewals than we initially anticipated. So if we correct the 93.6% for the one-off items and take them out, we believe ex post the underlying true combined ratio is 93%, more or less. How do we get from the 93% to the 95%? A number of changes. The two most important ones are portfolio mix changes and rate decreases. I would say roughly 75% of the difference between 95 and 93% is due to the rate decreases, which we have incurred already in our portfolio and which we expect to continue to incur for the rest of this year during the renewals. And the remaining half a point is caused by a mix of our portfolio. You see in our presentation in the appendix, as an example, our weighting shifted a little bit more towards more casualty, and casualty typically comes with a higher combined ratio. And this is an example what contributes to the higher combined ratio as a result of a change of business mix. Michel?
Thank you, Matt. Jason, I'm not totally sure that it will answer your question, but okay, I will do my best. On the first, I just would like to point out that the fact that these three investments came in the frame of 5 to 6 weeks is actually due to, well, it happened like that. Some of them have been definitively on our pipeline for more than 6, and one for more than 12 months. So please don't extrapolate anything in that respect, in the fact that we concluded all these three acquisitions in the frame of 6 months. We are definitively convinced that these acquisitions are a way to participate to the evolution of high-growth market in matters of insurance, and we did identify through these acquisitions I would say access to risk that we wouldn't have accessed through the classical business unit that we have. And we are in that respect deeply convinced of the long-term value of these investments. And I just also want to insist on the fact that these investments are included in our mid-term targets in matters of equity investment. So it's definitively also part of our asset management. But I don't think that we could have accessed some of the risk that we access through this investment by other channels than the one that we did choose. So I probably partly disagree with you on the fact that you have difficulty to find the strategic reasoning behind them.
Okay, so there is a business rationale for at least the two of them. You find that there is a business rationale, so that means you do think that through these stakes, you can, if there are growth opportunities, that, you know, that will help you to get involved as a reinsurer, rather than, you know, having the those that have the majority, if you want, saying, look, we have the pockets and we do not need you necessarily to. Am I correct in understanding that, you know, they are, you know, there nope. is a strong business rationale still within these two, at least the two of the three investments?
No, we are trying definitively not to mix what we do on the reinsurance side and what we do on the investment side. If the two things sometimes combine, perfect, but it's definitely not in order to consolidate our reinsurance policy that we are doing this investment. It's in order to access to risk to which we wouldn't have access with, I would say, the reinsurance and the corporate social solution pillar.
Okay, that's very clear. Thank you very much.
The next question comes from Tom Dorner from Citigroup. Please go ahead.
Hi there. So my first question is on reserve releases. You had another large release this year, and you always guide that we shouldn't assume that when we think about the sort of underlying profitability. Are you going to stick to that guidance, or should we sort of offset some of the deterioration in the underlying combined ratio with perhaps more of a regular expectation for reserve releases? And then the second question I had was on M&A and the principal investments. I just wanted to be clear. So when you say that there won't be any new investments that aren't funded by divestments, are you effectively saying you're not planning any more sort of material principal investments for now? I also wanted to check, I think in the past you've talked about potentially doing transactions to sort of bolt-ons for corporate solutions. Is that sort of included in that guidance as well? And if I can sneak one in, you mentioned in the presentation on the principal investments that you measure their progress on growth in underlying book value. Is that something that you'll be sort of sharing with us to try and assess how value creative they've been? Thanks.
Tom, I'll do 1 and 2B, and Michelle can do the second one. Reserve releases, the guidance stands. So we don't anticipate further reserve releases, and as we've said before, we don't plan for it. I mean, I think it's still a cyclical business, but guidance remains the same. Although the last piece of book value, we think, is the most appropriate longer-term driver for these things. I mean, you'll see the benefits of it in the group's balance sheet. I mean, you'll appreciate that some of these are actually private investments. So, I mean, I can't promise that every single quarter we can give you full transparency on everything. But, I mean, 2 of them are public, and you can see them just as clearly as we can. But book value growth is the principal target. Michelle?
Mm-hmm. Well, your conclusion is probably not wrong in the sense that we've said that we are at the top of the range that we allow ourselves for these type of investment. Probably the question is the definition of the now, but we definitely do not want you to extrapolate on the pace of the fourth quarter to think of the activities that we may have in the year 2014. So it will grow when the group grows. It will grow by potential divestiture in the principal investment portfolio. But these two conditions need to be accomplished to release some free capital to invest for the next investment that we want to achieve. The corporate solution plan did include, until 2015, some potential inorganic growth of relatively small companies, mainly in high-growth market. These are not extremely material, a few hundred million investments, and this one is not reviewed and is still part of our strategic planning for corporate solution until 2015. We do not have any immediate activity in view, and not only immediate, in reinsurance. In that respect, we believe that we can invest the capital in the structure that we have in an extremely efficient manner, and we don't need external activity in that respect.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Vinit Malhotra from Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. So my two questions. First is on the non-life profitability. What is the offset that gives you the confidence to say profitability or ROEs are unchanged? Is it an inbuilt in assumption of interest rate increases? Or why I'm asking, because you kind of alluded somewhere of a flat running yield outlook, and then we see a deteriorating combined ratio outlook, and then I'm trying to figure out where is the offset. And second question is on the growth initiative of $3 billion capital. I know it's not new, but could you just remind us once again about how much of this is likely to be cash and how much is just soft capital And obviously my motivation is to try to understand where we are 12 months from now in terms of deployable capital or cash. But that's 2A2B, which you can choose to answer accordingly. All right, thank you.
Thanks, Vineet. So I'll take both of those. So first of all, on what's the offset? So I guess there are three more obvious parts of offset. So when we talked about targets before, I mean, you probably remember that when we did the presentation back in June, I mentioned that we had allowed for some deterioration. We certainly hadn't allowed for the level that we've seen on the January 1 renewal, but we'd allowed for a piece of it. So part of it was baked in already. I guess the other two aspects that are available to us to offset, one is that, I mean, you mentioned the $3 billion in a second, so I'll come on to that. You'll notice that the $3 billion hasn't changed, despite the fact that we've declared another special dividend. So in essence, we're actually today promising essentially more capital flexibility than we had announced back in June. The last piece is you're aware that we've reduced the investment income by running short duration on the asset side, and that's performed reasonably well up to now. If we reverse that at some point over the course of the next 2 years, and we expect that we would, that would be a reasonably significant contributor, given if you take year-end interest rates as an example. I mean, I think it's really important to bear in mind that the scenario that I laid out, it wasn't intended to be projection. I mean, the environment's clearly tougher, but that scenario that I laid out wasn't intended to drain every single option that the company had. And we think we retain significant flexibility, which is why you see us reiterate what you've heard today. On the $3 billion itself, so obviously a large, very large piece of it is going to be cash, because if it's not, we're very restricted in how we can deploy it. So I mean, if it was illiquid, you'd be forced to find growth only in, for example, reinsurance or corporate solutions, and that's too limiting. So I mean, given the cash profile we've seen from the businesses, given the dividends that we anticipate to see in the early part of this year, and given what we hope for next year, we think we have full flexibility around that $3
billion. Okay. All right. Thanks, George.
The next question comes from Maciej Wasilewicz from Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Hi, it's Maciej from Morgan Stanley. I've got two questions. The first question is on the shift into casualty at 1-1. I know that on a one-year view, you could argue that yields are higher, and potentially even in parts of casualty rates are better. But sort of if you look on a longer view, maybe a 2 or 3 year view, you know, yields are probably still lower than they were, and rates might not even be as high as they were 3 years ago. I'm just wondering, what changed? What changed your mind about casualty that made you go into it in such a big way? Is it that there's a capital benefit that wasn't there a year ago, or is it that you actually think that the business is now more profitable than it was a few years ago? So you should grow into it. The second question I have is on the capital deployment again. Given that your principal investments is more or less capped for now, you can define that how you will, in non-life reinsurance, the growth options seem a little bit constrained. In life reinsurance, you'd argue the same. It's difficult to see how you can deploy $3 billion over a two-year view even, given those constraints. Perhaps can you unpack the most likely trajectory for where that $3 billion could go, maybe even if it's in ranges? I know Admin Re will be one of them, but $3 billion is a lot for Admin Re, so if you could give an answer there. Thank you.
So Matt's going to tackle number one, and I'll tackle number two. Matt?
Okay, the first question, why did we go into casualty in a big way, using your words? I would like to first adjust these words a little bit. We did not go into casualty in a big way. We are expanding our casualty writings in a controlled way. And the rationale is very simple. If I compare property versus casualty, then we are seeing on the property side, especially related to the cat-exposed portion within property, relatively major decreases in price quality. On the casualty side, we are seeing buckets where the price quality is actually going up. We are seeing buckets where the price quality stayed more or less flat, and we saw also buckets where the price quality decreased a little bit. But on average, the price changes on the casualty side were significantly smaller than on the property side. As a result of this, a number of deals on the property side dropped below the threshold of profitability, and we decided there to protect our portfolio and let this business go and non-renew it. On the casualty side, this happened to a much smaller extent. In addition to that, we were able, especially also in the US, to produce some additional business which we were not on in the past, and this additional business came with a sufficient price quality and expected profitability for us to write. So that's basically our rationale and the reason why we shifted a little bit away from property more into casualty. But please believe me, it's a very controlled shift, and by no means did we go into casualty in a big way.
So, Matthew, on the second point on the capital deployment, it may be worth just going back to the two presentations where we talked about this before, which is both of the investor days, 211 and 212. I mean, that number was calibrated to our view of a hypothetical buyback. That sets the benchmark for the capital deployment. We have a plan that we've presented to our board where we have earmarks for various investments that we believe we can make in our various units during the course of this year. As you point out, none of them are particularly easy. The environment is fairly challenging. And as you've heard already, on some areas, we're limited by our risk appetite. But, I mean, for reasons you can probably appreciate, I'm not going to outline them all one by one, nor give you ranges. I mean, the one thing that I guess we've all become accustomed to is that plans in this business on a 12-month horizon have a habit of changing. I guess the one thing I can assure you of is that we remain committed to our financial discipline and will only deploy the capital in new business if the new business achieves the hurdle rates that we've previously stated.
Does the $3 billion, perhaps I can ask, the $3 billion, you've already mentioned inorganic growth potential for Corso. I don't know, I guess maybe you can't answer this, but is inorganic growth a significant component of the plan, or is it mainly in inorganic growth that the $3 billion is earmarked for?
So, I mean, I think Michelle gave you a sense of what was planned for Corso already, and I think he even started to quantify it and put some brackets around it. I mean, Admin Re, I don't think it qualifies as organic necessarily, but it's fairly close, and we are prepared to invest more money in Admin Re, again, if we can find transactions at the right rates of return. I mean, beyond that, I'm not prepared to go.
Okay. No, thank you very much.
The next question comes from William Hardcastle from Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Thanks, guys. Regarding the surplus over the S&P AA rating, I'm just trying to marry up the $3 to $5 billion target that you have. And should I take the $3 billion dividend off the in excess of $10 billion, as well as this $3 billion capital deployment in order to marry them up, or am I taking too much off there? And regarding this combined ratio guidance, could you... Obviously, part of the mix is due to the casualty shift. It's important just to have an idea of what the average duration on that casualty book will be. Are you able to say what specific casualty it is in and what the average duration of that will be?
So I'll do number one, and Matt gets the pleasure of number two. So in the S&P number, more than $10 billion above the minimum for AA is before the dividend. So... I mean, as you look into the year that comes, you need to allow for the payments yet to be made. Matt, on the combined ratio?
Yeah, I think the duration of the casualty business, so as a rule of thumb, I would use something in the area of 6-7 years. approximately, typically motor business comes with a lower duration, especially in Asia, not necessarily in Europe, but in Asia it is the case. And general liability is a little bit longer, and workers' compensation business is extremely long. But we continue to have pretty much no appetite to go long on the workers' compensation business side.
Okay, that's very clear. Thanks.
The next question comes from William Hawkins from KBW. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much. Can you help me with the maths on the life side and just give me a guide of what operating margin, using your new definition, you think is consistent with a 10 to 12% ROE? That would be kind. And then, yeah, I'm just interested again on the subject of the switch of your business mix in the P&C. Am I thinking about it the right way to say that if you've shifted 10% of your portfolio from property to casualty, and that's led to a 50 basis point increase in the combined ratio, the combined ratio that you're writing the casualty at is only 5 points higher than the combined ratio you were writing the property at. That seems to me to be the math, but it sort of implies that there's less of a difference between casualty and property than I might have thought. Thanks.
So I guess we're going to form a habit. I'll do number one and Matt will do number two. So on the operating margin, I mean, believe it or not, well, I haven't actually tried to re-engineer it, but I guess if I was going to do it, and I guess I should have done, the way I would do it is as follows. We'd assume the market value volatility related items are zero, so that's VA, GMDB, B36, etc. I would take the 10 to 12 ROE that we have for 2015, and I would tax it, and that should be broadly what the operating margin would be. But apologies, I haven't tried to calculate in advance.
That makes sense. Thanks.
Matt?
Okay. The portfolio shift. I used casualty as an example because it's a very obvious one and one that is easily visible to you because we are showing to you the pie chart that compares our 2014 1-1 renewal business split with the respective pie chart of the expiring business. However, it is not necessarily the only shift in our portfolio we are experiencing. So your math would be correct if it was the only shift, but this assumption is not entirely true. For instance, one effect which is a little bit challenging for me to describe, but I'll try it anyway, is the following. You know, we had the Berkshire Hathaway quota share in place, and this quota share expired at the end of 2012. This Berkshire Hathaway quota share was structured so that we could cede individual risks and treaties on a risks attaching basis, which means a contract, a treaty that was written in Q4 2012 could be ceded in its entirety to the Berkshire quota share, which is why it has an effect also in 2013 and even in 2014. And the reason why it has also an impact in 2014 is the following. Typically, our pro rata treaties themselves are written on a risks attaching basis, which means we could cede in Q4 a pro rata treaty to the in Q4 2012 a pro rata treaty to the Berkshire Hathaway quota share that lasts till Q4 2013, which means a policy that was written in Q4 2013 could still be ceded to this pro rata treaty, which was ceded to the Berkshire Hathaway quota share, which is the reason why we have exposure and an impact also in 2014. The difference between pro rata and non-proportional is most of the time written on a losses occurring basis, which means once the treaty period is over, the exposure is over, whereas pro rata treaties are written on a risks attaching basis, which means after the expiration of the treaty, there is also the runoff. As a result of this, in 2013, we had a bigger Berkshire Hathaway impact for proportional runoff than for non-proportional exposure. And this impact will go away largely in 2014, as a result of which we retain a little bit more pro rata exposure in 2014 than we did in 2013. And that contributes, dilutes a little bit the clear logic of your calculation and of your argument. I don't know whether I was able to make myself clear. It's not totally easy. I'm happy to follow up if you have a wish to do so with me.
No, I think I got the gist. Thank you.
The next question comes from Andrew Broadfield from Barclays. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon. Two questions, please. The first one on corporate solutions. I was just wondering where your confidence comes for the 4 percentage point improvement between the underlying this year that actually was incurred and the guidance for next year. And the second question on the P&C reinsurance, on the absolute size of the claims reserves, they came down another 5% or so this year in absolute size. And they've come down, I think, 20-odd percent in the last 4 or 5 years. Clearly, the Berkshire Hathaway treaty has something to do with that, and also some of your shrinkage during that period as well. I had kind of anticipated this year would be relatively flat, and clearly it isn't. Should we expect next year to be growth again, or is this still going to be a two-year turnaround, particularly as your portfolio is starting to move into slightly longer duration risks as well, which I would have expected to have a more compounding impact on the asset side of the balance sheet.
Matt Corso, for you.
Okay, so I'll take the Corso combined ratio question. So basically, you are asking, how do we get from the 99% 2013 factual normalized combined ratio to the 95% 2014 guidance? And the walk is relatively simple. It's driven by volume growth, which significantly exceeds the anticipated growth in expenses. And that more than explains the 4% reduction in the combined ratio. On top of this, we believe we will experience a little bit an offset by price level changes, which we think we will also experience on the direct insurance side for corporate solutions. And together, these two effects add up to a reduction in the combined ratio of 4 percentage points. That's how we get from 99 to 95%.
Sorry, just on the pricing side, I couldn't quite tell which way you're saying that's going. It's getting better or worse?
So on the pricing side, so the volume side helps us. That reduces the combined ratio. I was saying it in our anticipation, it is expected to reduce the combined ratio by more than 4 points. And part of this, however, will be offset by an anticipated softening on the price side, and together these two effects amount to a reduction in the combined ratio of 4 points.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you.
So I'll deal with the second one, Andy. On the reserving side of things, so you listed some of the drivers in the past, so Berkshire Hathaway being the most obvious, our own cycle management starting in 2008. Also, I think an important factor to bear in mind, I mean, not more recently, but certainly in the not too distant past, was the runoff of a fairly large chunk of the GEIS acquisition. Now, on the balance sheet side of things, I mean, I tend to focus less on the consolidated claim view because you've got a number of moving parts in there, not least of which is foreign exchange, and focus more on the cash flows. And for me, the cash flows tend to give you a better indication of what's happening in terms of the asset balances of the group. And we're certainly starting to move back into positive cash flow overall. And you see that partly reflected in the cash flow up through the group to the holding company. I mean, I think that's the best way I can answer that question for the time being, Andy.
So your point is it's positive now, so you should be more positive next year.
So we're at a trough, so you'd expect it to improve.
Okay, thanks.
The next question comes from Kamran Hossain from RBC. Please go ahead.
Hi, I've just got two questions. The first one is just coming back to the renewals. Volume 6% down there. In terms of thinking about that 6%, was that all due to kind of return thresholds not being met? Or were there some contracts that actually met those thresholds that you lost out on? And the second question, just touch on admin re. Seems like you're open for business again in the UK. Would you rule out any European transactions there? Thanks.
So Matt's going to do the first one. I think between me and Michelle, we'll handle the second one.
Matt? Okay. So with respect to the 6%, a portion of the reduction is explained just by rate decreases. So in terms of exposure reduction, our exposure reduced, but it did not reduce by 6%. It reduced by less. With respect to the rest, it is a combination of either return thresholds not being met, in some cases also terms and conditions. Please remember, softening does not only happen on the price side, softening can also happen on the wording side. And we definitely have encountered here and there a wording which softened to an extent where we had to decide that we can no longer support this wording for a number of reasons, for instance, misaligned interests with the insureds or things like this. So it's a combination of multiple factors.
On the admin read, maybe just make a comment before Michelle. I mean, Cameron, it's really nitpicking, but I guess we don't see it as open again. I mean, we were open for business last year. We'd have been very happy to do a transaction, but I guess the reality of trying to run multiple processes at the same time just defeated us, and it wasn't possible. But we are open for business. Michelle, on the geographical dimension.
Well, definitely, you know, the experience of last year brought at least something positive is the conviction of the value of the platform in the UK, and the focus on the UK for the next 18 to 24 months is definitely the result of these conclusions.
So no plans for European transactions?
Sorry, I didn't get that one.
So no plans for European transactions at the moment?
It depends on the transaction, but definitely not part of our focus.
Thanks very much.
By the way, UK is part of Europe, if I remember well.
Sure. It depends, Michelle.
The next question comes from Michael Huttner from JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I have, I think the first one will be for you, George, and the second maybe for. So if I think about your move to Zurich, and I assume this was done with full consent, support, et cetera, from the board of Swiss Re. Is it a case of we need to help our neighbours, they're nice neighbours, we do a lot of business with them, here, have our star, we'll kind of almost lend him to you, in other words, a kind of, you know, within such a strong position, it's an easy move for us? Or is it more driven by the idea that you know, if you move there, you can maybe aim to become the equivalent of Michelle Lys in the not too distant future. And then the second question is much On the, you're kind of saying, well, you'd expect the market to remain soft or to continue softening, I don't know, for the renewals coming up. Could you give some light on what, how you or where you expect it to soften or how much? That would be really helpful. I'm assuming, and I've kind of not done log numbers, but implicit in all those is softening, which isn't huge, it's about 2 or 3%, as far as I can figure. But it's a question. Thank you.
Just on the first one, before giving the word to George, Michael, first, you always ask easy questions. And I didn't know that George wanted to become Luxembourgeois.
Very good. Lovely.
I don't know how many different kinds of trouble an answer to your question could get me into. I take it as a compliment.
Always a compliment.
Yes. You appreciate it. I enjoy my job here as CFO. I mean, you've heard from me before my reasons for going. David Cole will be a wonderful replacement for me, and I'm looking forward to being CFO up the street, but that's the limit of what I'm going to say today on that job. Matt?
Okay. Expectation on the price level side for the rest of 2014... I would say on the Nat Cat side, we will probably see a softening, but the softening which we are going to see will be significantly smaller than the softening we saw at the 1-1 renewals. And the reason is, if you look back to 2013, in 2013, the market softening started to become evident basically with the April 1 renewals, which means the cat business that is going to be renewed April 1, 2014 has or will have experienced already one round of market softening. And the 6-1 and the 7-1 cat renewals will have experienced already one round of massive market softening. As a result of this, I would expect to see a softening, but the softening will decrease probably substantially over the course of 2014. But you know how it is with forecasts. It's very hard to forecast into the future. That's just a reflection of our current thinking. On the casualty side, it depends a little bit what is happening on the reserve development side in the industry. We expect sooner or later, probably rather sooner than later, the cookie jar with the excess reserves will be empty, and it will be recognized that the cookie jar is empty. And once this is happening, it will lead to earnings pain on the casualty side, and we believe that will provide a floor to the rate changes on the casualty side. With respect to specialty lines, there actually we have seen already in the area of engineering and marine, for instance, a stabilization of the rate driven by losses which happened in the past. So there our expectation is rates will probably be flat for the rest of the year, maybe even increase a little bit. Aviation, there the rates will continue to be driven by the occurrence or non-occurrence of big disasters. So absent the big disaster, I would expect their rates to continue to erode, as we have seen in the past.
That's lovely. You will be able to say how much of your cat renewals is in the three periods, January, April, and June, July? Is it like 20%, 20%, 60%?
So are you asking what is the distribution of the renewal premium across the quarters?
Mm-hmm. So just for cat.
Okay, so in January, it's roughly two-thirds of our book. So I would say maybe 60, 65%. April is approximately 10%. June, July is approximately 17%, and the rest is distributed through the month in the second half of the year.
But that's for all of our treaty business, that's not just CAT.
That's correct. CAT is a little bit more concentrated towards the middle of the year, so we have a higher portion of CAT renewals that will happen in June and July.
That's very kind. Thank you.
The next question comes from Andrew Ritchie from Autonomous Research. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi there. Just 2 points of clarification. George, I think with reference to an earlier question talking about the 2015 EPS target, you said it is tougher than your original assumptions. You did build in an erosion of property cap margins. But I just wanted to clarify, are you saying that erosion is greater than you expected, but the resilience of other classes and or the ability to redeploy more capital has offset those pressures? I'm just trying to understand how much tougher it is, and are we on the point where you're kind of feeling there's still room for pricing to fall, or how much kind of room you have? I just was a bit confused by your answer to that earlier on. Related to that, capital management, just clarification, I'm assuming the broad target is still a combination of 3 to 5 billion excess on a AA S&P and an SST of 185. I guess the S&P is more the binding constraint for now. And to clarify on that capital front, there's a sub-question, I'm afraid. The COCOs, I'm guessing, haven't yet got approval as part of SST. Thanks.
Answer to the first one, I guess I was trying to imply that we believe we have enough flexibility for the time being to offset what we're seeing in the P&C market. So I was trying to imply we believe we still have flexibility to achieve the target. On the capital management, your summary is spot on. So we do have those targets, and S&P currently is the constraint. On the COCO side of things, we don't yet have approval for recognition from FINMA. That's not because there's a particular problem. I think I've mentioned before, it's because of the innovative treatment that we had sought and the time that was required for the regulator to be comfortable and either then approve or disapprove it. We don't yet have that approval, and I don't really expect that to be forthcoming in the very near future, but we do expect to receive credit for that in our capital model in due course.
And the S&P, presumably the only other items, obviously the dividend has to be netted off, are the life and health restructuring and the final tranche of the Berkshire Hathaway effect. Is that right?
It is, if you only take the negative things in the income statement for 2014.
Right.
So that's a negative way of putting it. I mean, you have an expectation of making money this year, is what I meant to say.
Sure, yeah. Okay, thank you.
The next question comes from Michael Quinn from Nomura. Please go ahead.
Oh, yes, hello. I had two questions as well. Firstly, would be again on capital return or your approach to capital return. Probably, hopefully, a quite simple question. Now, at the moment, you're paying the dividend from additional paid in capital, so it's exempt from withholding tax. If I understand correctly, at the end of 2013, you had about 5 billion balance. So if you pay the current dividend and special dividend, that will be about 2 billion, which then means that you will have probably exhausted the amount of additional paid in capital by the end of next year. Does this change in any way your approach to capital return via dividends, or would this then change also towards buybacks? My second question would be on Admin Re, hopefully also very quick. You're talking about on the presentation that you're looking to use leverage to finance potential growth here. How should we view this in the overall group strategy of actually reducing leverage? Thank you.
So on the first one, I guess my answer is relatively rapid. I mean, every year that we start with the intention of looking to deploy the capital that we have available to us. So, I mean, we haven't yet discussed what the approach will be once we've exhausted the tax-free capacity that we currently have, but your numbers are correct. On the leverage, essentially what we're doing today is, again, flagging what we had, something that I think we had said already at the Investor Day back in June. So even as the group leverage comes down substantially, which really means reinsurance, we expect to add some leverage both to AdminRe and, in fact, to Corporate Solutions over time to normalise their leverage structure. But that will still result in an achievement of the net target we had of more than $4 billion reduction by 2016. In fact, we are by far most of the way through that already. We'll give an update when we publish the economic numbers with Q1, because, of course, the economic numbers are the basis for the metrics that we've set for that.
Perfect. Thank you very much for the clarification.
The next question comes from Stefan Schürmann from Bank Vontobel. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. I have two questions. The first one on AdminRe, I feel like your basically ROE guidance is more positive than it was. If you can just maybe give us some idea what makes you more positive here. Is that the investment side or is there any other issues in here? The second one on the principal investments, I understand they are moving to group items. I think that was knocking off roughly like 4.4 billion of investment income to non-life. Is that more or less the figure we should basically take from one segment to the group items segment going forward, or is it a bit less? So it's just sort of giving a feel on the running yield of these items.
Stefan, so I think I'll try both of those. So on the first one on AdminRe, you're absolutely right. We deliberately made a very modest change in the guidance, and that's because of what we think the team can achieve, and in fact has at least partially achieved through some of the operational improvement they've delivered already. I mean, to put it in context, low to mid-single digits is not the limit of the ambition, but it's certainly an improvement over the expectation that we had before. On the principal investment side, just to clarify that change took place already Q2 last year. So Q3 and Q4 on a standalone basis, P&C Re already does not have the benefit of those returns. And that's, I haven't tried to calculate the number, and it'll be a bit volatile because of the nature of the assets. But if you look there and compare it to the prior year, that'll be the best source of how to estimate the impact. But you've already seen most of it during the course of 2013.
Okay, yeah, very good. Thank you.
The next question comes from Olivia Brindle from Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead.
Hi there. A couple of questions, please. Firstly, on the capital fungibility side, you've previously pointed us to the group shareholders' equity as an indication of the sort of immediate flexibility that you have on the capital. So that number is still about $5 billion, less $1.5 billion of private equity, which, again, you've mentioned previously, suggesting $3.5 billion of immediate flexibility. You did say that was something you might be looking into improving, so I'm just wondering whether there's been any change or progress on that front, and if not, what sort of time frame might we expect for that improvement to come through? Secondly, on AdminRe, just to clarify, are you still potentially looking to engage third-party partners, given that you have been unable to get, I suppose, the right valuation relative to what you feel is right? Does that make it effectively less likely that that you'll look to do that, and we should realistically expect that this will now stay on your books going forward? And then, if I may also just very quickly on Corporate Solutions, you mentioned a $91 million gain on derivative accounted weather and NatCat. That's about a third of the profit for that division. So I'm just wondering if you could give a bit more colour on that and how stable that is going forward. Thank you.
So I will try one and three, and Michelle will comment on AdminRe. So on the capital fungibility first, your numbers are spot on with one exception, Olivia. So remember that we did the principal investments, so the three investments that we announced back in October, November time, FWD, Sul America, and New China, also were paid from that pot. So the liquidity of that pot dropped as a result of that asset allocation. Having said that, though, we're going to reload the thing during the course of Q1 and Q2. So we are anticipating significant dividends from most of the operating units. We've given guidance already on AdminRe and what you can expect there. And we also expect reinsurance subject to regulatory approval to also make a significant payment. So that's really what I was referring to. So, I mean, I don't think you'll see it all by the end of Q1, but certainly by the end of Q2, you'll have seen the cash replenished at the holding company. And I think our capital fungibility continues to be extremely strong. On Corso, you're right to highlight this. That's not the most sustainable component of Corso's earnings. In a normal year, I mean, it wouldn't be 90 million. I wouldn't want to give guidance for that particular item of the earnings statement for Corso. But I mean, it would be a lot less probably than even half of that in a typical period. But it's a, I mean, I guess it's a derivative form of a traditional business. I mean, it's the traditional risks that we take. But for some clients, it has to be written in derivative form, and that's why you see it there. It was a very strong year for Corso in that business last year. Michelle, admin re?
Yeah, actually, the short answer is yes. As we've said, admin re is definitely an important part of our strategy and a core business. We simply do not think that financing 100% of the acquisition does add a lot to the strategic dimension. And if there is something which has been achieved during 2013, thanks to the work done by the team, is the conviction that we should not compromise on the conditions in which this third-party capital should come in. So still solidly convinced of the strategic importance of having this third-party capital, but also convinced on the price which should be paid.
Great, thank you.
The next question comes from Frank Hopfinger from Commerzbank. Please go ahead.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon, everybody. I have two questions. My first question is on the price decline during the renewals, the 3.6%. This takes into account also the interest rate movement. Can you give some guidance where this figure were to end if you were to exclude this interest rate movement, and also whether you could give some guidance how this splits in for looks for the non-proportional part of the business and the proportional book. And my second question is also follow up on the insurance derivatives in the course of business. Could you give some guidance whether they overall increase the volatility of the segment or not? So if you have a benign nut cut experience, which is good for the combined ratio, whether this will also shift the realized gains on the P&L?
Okay, so as usual, Matt's number one, I'm number two.
Okay. So the price quality change of 3.6% includes interest rates, it includes nominal price changes, it includes exposure trends, loss trends, and it includes also changing terms and conditions. So as such, it provides a full economic view. At this point, we are not disclosing the individual components of the 3.6%, but they are all included.
Frank, on the second one, I haven't looked in detail at the capital model to work out whether or not it's diversifying or not. I mean, I suspect it must be partially correlated. I mean, the derivatives are mainly weather-related, so there must be some correlation to some of the more weather-related natural catastrophe exposures that Corso runs. I mean, that's probably the best I can answer this question today.
Okay, thanks.
The next question is a follow-up question from Jason Calambusis from Societe Generale. Please go ahead.
Yes, I think that on admin RIA, I just only had one clarification compared to what was asked. It is on the when you have moved to, say, a mid-single-digit ROE, does that include the releveraging you're planning to do, or that could take you further? Also, what is the component that brings you, you know, from, is it the asset allocation that brings you, you know, to the 5%? And also more to understand, if it's possible, it is, when we're looking, you're saying that, you know, you could do a transaction. I mean, clearly for AdminRe, you do need to do a transaction to kind of feed the machine, as Bob is saying. So does it, you know, what sort of, of course, it will depend on price, but, you know, would that give us a further increment, if you want, on the ROE outlook that you will have? The final thing is just around, again, the same thing. So you have you're going to upstream an incremental 200 million dividends from AdminRe. Where is that coming from, and could we, you know, are we going to be getting, on what that is dependent, are we going to get some good positive surprises like that every now and then? Because it seems to all go in the right direction, but not always able to figure out why and how we're getting this positive development.
So I'll start. Maybe Michelle will add the on the ROE. I mean, just to correct you a wee bit, Jason. So we haven't forecast mid single digit ROE. We said low to mid. Apologies for the.
No, before you had low and now you move to low to mid.
Correct, that's absolutely spot on.
It's my mistake.
Does that incorporate the plans that we have for the additional leverage? It does. I mean, over time, as we further adjust the capital structure, then maybe there's room for more improvement. But certainly we've built some of that into the expectation that you've heard already. Upstream, I mean, the point around surprises, I mean, I'm going to resist the temptation to answer that. I mean, it wouldn't be a surprise. I mean, we've set out the risk tolerance for the business unit. I mean, that's what determines whether or not we expect the business to pay dividends. We tend to look at things on a gross basis, so even if they want to do a new investment, the money at least notionally comes back to us first, and then we make a decision as to whether we reinvest. The one positive that does remain on the ROE is new transactions. So, I mean, given the hurdle rate that we have for new deals and given the ROE of the existing business, you would expect new transactions to average up the current ROE.
Okay, very good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Question is a follow-up question from Vinit Malhotra from Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Thanks. I'll keep it brief. One thing we didn't hear from you today was retrocession cost saves or that kind of some positive effect on the combined ratio and the renewals. So if you could just comment on retrocession. Also in the same line, if you could comment on in terms and conditions, because you used to do a lot of multi-year deals in the past. And lastly, on reserve releases, I noticed that both 3Q and 4Q had similar components in that Sandy was releasing reserves and also casualty A&E reserves. So casualty maybe I can understand, but Sandy is a short tail. Could you just comment on why subsequent quarters see reserve releases of a sizable magnitude there? Thank you.
So I think Matt's going to do the retrocession and the terms and conditions, and I'll talk about reserve releases.
Okay, so retrocession for us does not have the same importance as it would have if we were a smaller player in the market. While we hedge our portfolio, especially with respect to U.S. hurricane to a certain degree, it is not a huge amount, and therefore the market softening that definitively also affects the retrocession market does not affect us to the same extent as it does with some of our competitors. Just as a reminder, we do not write ourselves retrocession business. And we will continue to not do this. The problem we have with it, we believe the business is completely intransparent. At the time, you have to make a decision whether or not to write it. You have no idea what the underlying exposure is. And therefore, we continue to have no appetite for this type of business. With respect to terms and condition changes, we have seen, by the way, the changes are mostly concentrated on the property side. We have not really seen terms and condition softening on the casualty side or on the specialty side. But on the property side, we have seen attempts, for instance, to prolong the hours clause. In the wordings, we have also seen attempts to include perils that were formerly excluded or get rid of reinstatement premiums. And there our approach was, it depends on what the changes are. Some of the changes, for instance, prolonged hours clause, are not critical per se. The changes come with a price tag. The longer the hours clause is, the more you need to charge in addition. And that's exactly what we did. We tried to charge more, and in those cases where the market did not allow us to charge more, we reduced the rate adequacy in the comparison we are disclosing to you. There are other terms and condition changes, such as, for instance, eliminating reinstatement premium, which we did not accept, by the way, and the reason is they eliminate also the alignment of interest between the reinsured and the reinsurer, and this is something which in our opinion is potentially dangerous, and therefore we heavily resisted this and were actually successful not accepting such changes. George, over to you.
So just summarize, the hours clauses were extended and you could not get enough pricing for that. That's what you just said, just to summarize?
To the extent that this happened, that would be equivalent to a deal where, due to economics, the deal no longer passed our hurdle rate, our technical requirements. And to the extent that this happened, we would not renew this deal.
Also, this was not successful. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. And then on the reserve release side of things, just to give everyone the same information basis, so I'll focus on P&C Re. We had about $300 million of reserve release in the fourth quarter and about $1.1 billion for the year in total. If you excuse my shortcut mathematics, broadly, both for the quarter and for the year, you can split the reserve release into three pieces, property, casualty, and specialty. And for both pieces, they're in a similar range. So property is a reasonably significant driver. In Q4, as you pointed out, we reduced Sandy. So obviously as time moves on, maybe we gain more certainty around our estimates, we get more reported information from clients, and therefore we arrive at better estimates over time, and that, of course, has had a positive impact for us. For the full year, not only Hurricane Sandy, also Thai floods, a Japanese earthquake, been one of the larger influences in the year, partially offset by an increase on the New Zealand earthquake. I guess the one thing I would highlight is that, the ability of this to have some influence on the reserve releases actually relies on us having significant Nat Cat reserves. And, of course, these numbers have been running down over the last few years as we both pay and receive more information. So hopefully we're moving towards a position of more certainty, particularly around property.
Okay. Thank you, George.
The last question for today comes from Thomas Forsart from HSBC. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. Just a quick question back to your 2014 Chan renewals. On the $9 billion of volumes renewed, of premium renewed. Are you able to tell us how much was the on the global segment, and are you able to tell us what has been the differential in terms of volumes and pricing compared to the rest of the book?
So, Thomas, we don't break out globals as a separate reporting segment, and we wouldn't do that here for renewal either. Apologies.
That was the last question.
So with that, I would like to conclude the meeting. Thank you very much, everybody, for your participation, and goodbye.